We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
And this is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Freinas at the controls this morning. In a moment, we'll be inviting your questions for Dr. Jeff Swearingen from Carl. He's a family medicine physician, and every other month he's here and we do the show we like to call Talk to the Family Doctor. The idea is that it's kind of wide open if you have health care questions. Could be for yourself, someone in your family. He sees people of all ages in his practice, grown-ups, kids. And we have built this into the schedule so people can have this regular opportunity to ask health questions. We do a lot of shows like that that are about asking questions and we hope giving you some useful information. Well, what we're now doing is turning around and saying, if you've benefited from this show, if you benefit from the other programs that we have, they also need your support. Here in studio with me is Kim Cronick. She's our Director of Community Engagement. What should people do?
Well, they should call in right now. The doctor is in. Now we need you to call in at 217-244-9455 right now with your pledge. $40 is the basic membership. You can use your Visa, MasterCard, Discover. You can also call pledge online, willpledge.org. But the most important thing is to call in now and not miss any of the answers the doctor's going to give and other people's questions that may relate to your own needs. We're very proud to provide this kind of expert advice and interaction. That's one of the things we are hopeful to do, is to be relevant in your life. We believe that that's worth supporting, and we'd like you to make a pledge right now. 217-244-9455. We want to hear from 1,000 people by the 17th, the end of this drive. We are more than a quarter of the way there. Let's get 5 calls and pledges during this program. You be the first one, 217-244-9455.
All right. Well, we're happy to have Dr. Jeff with us once again. He's been very generous with his time now for a number of years, coming by every other month so that we can do these shows. If you have a question, give us a call. He will do his best to help you out. I'll try to say when we have physicians on the show that we can't do diagnosis over the phone because the doctor cannot see you. If you really have a real concern, you should be seen. But this is a place that you can start, get a little basic knowledge, ask some questions, and I know he'll do his best to answer them. You may call us at 333-9455. Or if you're not in the immediate area, use the toll-free line 800-222-9455. And now we have the email, so if you'd like to send your question that way, you can do that right to will-talk, just like it sounds, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, David. Glad to be back.
Well, just are we now finally, can we say that we're done with flu now?
In terms of the seasonal flu, yes, I think so. The H1N1 people sort of discovered previously that it can be present year-round, but the sort of peaks and valleys that we've had, I'm pretty sure we're past all of our peaks and we should be in a bit of a valley now.
Do you know off the top of your head how many people, say, in Champaign County were vaccinated for H1N1?
Oh, that I don't know an actual number, but the feedback from my patients is any indication, I think a fair number of people did take the opportunity to go out and get it, which I think was excellent. All of the publicity about H1N1 was actually quite useful in reminding people that the seasonal flu shot is important as well. And so I think quite a few people did take advantage of that, but I don't know the exact numbers.
Yeah. I thought maybe I remember hearing it was something like maybe about 25%, but you know, that I may just be making that up. I guess the only reason I'm asking is that if you probably assume that you're never going to get 100% of people vaccinated. So is there a number that says if you get X percentage of people vaccinated, then that really is good enough so that you can reduce the incidence of that disease?
The difference here would be between the seasonal flu and the H1N1 because they both had different target populations. So with the H1N1, the younger patients the children, adolescents, young adults, and pregnant patients were the high-risk group, and consequently, it wasn't as important to immunize the elderly for H1N1, but in fact, the reverse is true for the seasonal flu. It's the elderly who are at highest risk for the seasonal flu. So in that particular age group, you want them to be immunized against the seasonal flu, whereas your sort of middle-aged adult didn't need to worry too much about the seasonal flu if they were otherwise healthy. So within the target population, if you can get a sizable proportion, and you'd like to get as many as you could, but if you can probably get half the population immunized, in addition to protecting those individuals, you significantly decrease the likelihood that it can spread to the other individuals, even those who aren't immunized.
Mm. Well, one other question, and I promise I have a caller I'm going to get right to. So now we're talking about things kind of winding down, but we're really only about 6 months away from the next
cycle.
The next cycle. So are now the people who produce the vaccine, are they now deciding or have they already decided which flu strains they're going to put into the next seasonal flu vaccine?
That will be coming up in the next few months. They'll look at all of the data that's been collected as to which strains were most prevalent, which ones did the most harm, and then indeed come up with a new formulation for next year's flu shot, which usually covers several different types of influenza, but there isn't any one vaccination that covers all types of influenza, or for that matter, other viral illnesses, which can occur seasonally as well.
So do you think then in the next vaccine, the one that they'll be giving for seasonal flu next fall, will H1N1 be in that?
It's quite possible.
So we won't be having people to have two different shots.
Correct.
The idea is that they would be able to get one shot. They would pick which ones they think would be the most likely to be circulating, build that into the vaccine so we can get them all in with one shot.
And that is correct. The folks who put together the vaccine, as I said, study the data and put together what turns out to be sort of their best guess as to which ones are going to be prevalent. And, you know, to their credit, the vast majority of the time, they get it pretty darn close to being correct as to which virus strains are circulating. Occasionally, you know, they miss, and people aren't as well protected. But it's still very worthwhile to get the shot.
All right. We got a caller here. We'll get to. And anybody who is listening this morning, if you have healthcare questions, you're certainly welcome to call. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family medicine doctor at Carl in Urbana and is with us every other month. And we do this show. We call Talk to the Family Doctor. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. And here's a caller in Champaign. Line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Good morning. My question is about glaucoma. I've had eye exams annually for the last few years because I'm over 40, and the doctor has indicated that it looks like I may be in the early stages of glaucoma. So I went online to take a look and see how what kinds of treatments there are. It hasn't actually been officially diagnosed yet because they'd have to do further testing, which I didn't want to do immediately. And it seems that in the early stages, it's treated with one or more medications. And my concern is that I also have hypothyroidism, which I'm being treated with Synthroid. And it seems like the side effects of the glaucoma medication would tend to worsen the symptoms I already have with the hypothyroidism because it tends to cause fatigue and so on. And one of the questions I had is, how quickly does glaucoma tend to develop? Are there different things that tend to contribute to the speed of its development? And also, have you ever run into a case where you have a patient that has, you know, treatment for one symptom may end up causing problems with something else that they have? And how is the desired, you know, how that's worked out?
Your last question is an excellent one, and it is unfortunately a fairly common scenario in many aspects of medical practice where treatment of one particular condition with a medication then gives rise to either side effects or problems related to the medication for which then another medication is prescribed to counteract the effects of the first one. and this can get to be sort of a vicious circle. Ideally, if you have the perfect situation, you treat the first problem with a medication that is efficacious and doesn't produce any adverse side effects. So in many instances, if you do have a side effect, if you can change the type of medication to something that works just as well that doesn't have that particular side effect, that's probably preferable than simply adding another medication to counteract the side effect. What you mentioned relative to fatigue is a potential side effect of a class of drugs called beta blockers, which are commonly used for glaucoma. In many instances, the vast majority of people do not have that as a side effect because there's not a lot of systemic absorption of the medication from the eye drop, but it can occur with some individuals. And as such, if it is a big problem, then changing to a different class of medications to treat the elevated pressure in the eye is something that can be done. In most instances, there's more than one type of treatment that can be prescribed. And the list of side effects that a particular medication has is not necessarily indicating that everybody who takes it will get that particular side effect. So in most instances, it's a matter of picking the most reasonable medication first, seeing whether it works, seeing how well somebody tolerates it, and then if working fine, no additional adjustment, but if it's not working fine, then changing oftentimes to a different medication to get the same benefit but to reduce the side effects. So in your particular case, if the elevated pressure in the eye is confirmed to be persistent and treatment is recommended, there wouldn't be any problem with going ahead and starting the medication. If you notice a side effect, it's simply important to, you know, communicate that to your physician so that they can make the appropriate change in the medication.
Is the general purpose of the beta blocker to lower blood pressure?
When taken systemically, beta blockers are very commonly used to lower blood pressure, slow pulse, prevent migraine, headaches. They're used to treat congestive heart failure. So depending on which particular medication you're using, which route you're delivering it by, and the dose that you're giving, the general class of beta blockers are actually used for many, many different forms of treatment.
Mm-hmm. And what does the speed of progression of glaucoma generally tend to be?
Highly individual. What's considered to be acute glaucoma, where the pressure suddenly rises, is probably the most damaging. But even slowly progressive elevations in pressure over a long period of time can cause damage to the eye and significant loss of visual acuity. So it is something to be watched closely. And if persistently elevated, doing something to bring that pressure back down is certainly warranted.
Mm-hmm. But what sort of time frame are we looking at? Are we looking at 5 years, 10 years? I mean, how long does it generally take before, you know, glaucoma tends to progress to the severe stages?
That, again, is highly individual. So I don't have any way of answering that for a given person. There are some people who have slightly elevated pressures in their eye that never progress to frank glaucoma. There are other folks who've progressed very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. The bulk over a long period of time, months to years, will eventually suffer damage to the eye, but it's highly individual.
Right. Okay, well, thank you so much.
All right, thank you for the call. I guess that this also maybe gives us an opportunity to pitch the fact that even people who feel that their vision is fine, who don't need to have any correction, don't wear contact lenses, don't wear glasses, it is advised that at a certain point, eye exams be done for just this thing, because it's one of those things that doesn't have obvious symptoms.
Right. And I remind folks in the office, you know, who tell me, oh, you know, I don't wear glasses, so I don't need to go to the eye doctor. And I simply say, well, you're at an age where even if you think you're seeing okay and you don't think you need glasses or you don't think your prescription has changed if you are wearing glasses, that periodically your eye doctor will in fact measure the pressure in your eye to screen for glaucoma. And, you know, if normal, then, yeah, I can go back in a couple of years. But if it's not normal, it should indeed be followed up, because untreated glaucoma will indeed lead to significant visual loss.
Yeah. All right. Other questions, welcome. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen from Carl in Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And you may email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, we're headed into the allergy season.
We're already there.
Okay, in fact, for people who have spring allergies, April, May, they're the big.
It's already started.
And apparently, some people, I think, maybe it'd be really bad. So you've seen a lot of people already having problems?
Yes.
The reason I raise is that I came across an article, and I think that it was the folks at Consumer Reports were doing a survey of people with spring allergy problems, and essentially a lot of people said no matter what, that the avenues that were open to them to treat their symptoms were really not terribly good. What advantage do you get, particularly if you try not to deal with this yourself, but maybe you go have a consult with a doctor?
Mm-hmm. The mainstays of allergy treatment are, if you can identify what it is you're allergic to, avoid it. In many instances, however, here in central Illinois, what you're trying to avoid is what's blowing through the air, and it's virtually impossible to avoid it. So if you can't avoid it, then you try and block the response to it. And since histamine is one of the major chemicals released with an allergic response and is responsible for a lot of the symptoms that we attribute to allergies, blocking the histamines is one of the mainstays of treatment. So any of your antihistamine-type medications. During the course of the day, many people will use the generic forms of Zyrtec or Claritin because they're available over-the-counter and they tend to be non-sedating. Mm-hmm. At night, if you don't mind if your allergy medication puts you to sleep, then the generic form of Benadryl is often used because, unfortunately, one of its side effects is, in fact, sedation. But those types of medications are perfectly reasonable. They're available over the counter. In conjunction with that, any of the prescription inhaled nasal steroid medications, these are Nasacort, Flonase, Rhinocort, there's probably a half a dozen different type of medications that are quite similar. But you're basically using a little cortisone medication inhaled into the nose and the sinuses to stabilize the lining of those mucous membranes so that they're less susceptible to releasing histamine. There's a third class of medication referred to as leukotriene inhibitors. This is singular. There are a couple of other medications in that same general class that are available by prescription. If somebody is absolutely miserable and they say, I have done all that, you can give them cortisone-like medications, either by injection or by mouth. If somebody says, nothing's controlling my allergies, then basically a visit to the allergist. The testing that allergists do is not so much to confirm what it is that you're allergic to, because most people generally already know, but it's basically to perform the preparation of an extract that you will then get allergy shots for the next few years to hopefully produce what are called blocking antibodies that help reduce the allergic response long term. But allergy shots are not a short term solution to the allergy situation.
But that actually does work. You can train the person's body to a different sort of response?
Yes. Okay. You basically end up creating an immune response that helps block the allergic reaction.
Yeah. Do the prescription medicines like the inhaled steroids and this other, the
leukotriene inhibitors,
yeah. Do they really work significantly better than the older kind of things, the antihistamines that people have been taking forever, like Benadryl, or like the more recent ones like Claritin, that has the advantage is that it won't put you to sleep? I mean, do these other prescription medications, do they really work better?
Better? You probably don't prescribe them necessarily first. But if somebody says, I'm already taking Claritin and Benadryl and I'm not controlling my symptoms, adding one of the nasal steroids is reasonable. Actually, a fair number of recent medical studies have said that the nasal steroids probably are the best first-line treatment for allergies because they actually help prevent the chemical reaction that is generated by the allergic response. So I think it is reasonable to look at the nasal steroids in combination with an oral antihistamine as kind of the mainstay of initial treatment, with the leukotriene inhibitors, steroids, and allergy shots for those individuals who continue to have problems despite their best efforts. The one subset of patients with bad asthma whose asthma is often triggered by their allergies, I think it's important to be aggressive with the treatment of their allergies so that you don't get into a situation where you've really exacerbated their asthma. Because allergies in general are pretty annoying, but you know, not necessarily life-threatening. A bad asthma attack actually can be potentially life-threatening.
Yeah. And then for people who hear you talking about inhaled steroids and think, oh, well, steroids, that's really bad. Doing it that way, you don't get the...
With a topical preparation, a nasal spray, you're basically delivering medication to the lining of the nose and the sinuses, basically where you inhale it. There is relatively little systemic absorption.
Okay. Not going to go through your entire body.
But those concerns about systemic steroids, when you take a large quantity of oral steroids or you're getting lots of shots of cortisone-type medications, yes, there are a whole long list of potential side effects of people who take large doses for long periods of time.
Okay. I've got a call here. Let's get them on line number one in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, can you hear you just fine? Go ahead.
Okay, good. I'm wondering if the doctor has heard or learned something recently about xylitol, X-Y-L-I-T-O-L, 5-carbon sugar. There's a book in the new bookshelf at Urbana Library called Kiss Your Dentist Goodbye. Among other things, the writer, who is a woman dentist, writes about using xylitol in a nasal solution for allergies.
I'm afraid I have absolutely no knowledge of this particular subject.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks. I think isn't xylitol something that is used in a sweetener, and sometimes I think it's often put in chewing gum. And the idea is supposed to be that chewing that gum actually is not only is it better than chewing gum that has sugar, but that it has some sort of effect that it works against tooth decay. You know nothing about xylitol, my friend?
I'm going to have to defer to your dental guests.
All right. Well, we'll save that for the next time we have a dentist on the show. Dr. Jeff Swearingen is here. He's a family practice doctor, family medicine physician from Carl in Urbana. He's here every other month, and we talk about healthcare. And it's an opportunity for people to call in and ask questions and say, look, I've got this concern. What can you tell me about it? And it could be for you, could be for somebody in your family, could be for your children. It's an information resource that we provide here on a regular basis. One of a number of people that are here on a regular basis to try to help out with basic everyday stuff. Well, this show is here 10 times a week, a lot of different things, all through the year, and we're here commercial-free, and we're here commercial-free because people like you who are listening, I hope, will support the station with your dollars. Kim Kronick is here in the studio with me. She's our Director of Community Engagement and is here to encourage folks to go to that phone and give us a call.
Yes, that number is 217-244-9455 or willpledge.org. You know, David, I've been listening with you and the doctor, and today you've already talked about H1N1 and seasonal flu and eye exams and glaucoma and allergies. And I got to tell you, I've learned a lot just listening this morning about the program. Thought of my own question to ask the doctor after the show. So this is a great resource, and we'd like you to contribute. 40% of our operating costs come from you, the listener, who becomes a member by making a financial contribution at 217-244-9455. You can put your membership on a Visa, Discover, MasterCard. You can send a check. You can do it online at willpledge.org. We want to have 1,000 people pledging during this fund drive, which ends on Saturday. Today's our first day of the week during this drive, and we have started off very well. We are more than a quarter of a way to reaching 1,000 memberships by the end of the drive, but we need your call of support right now at 217-244-9455. We don't want you to miss any of this good information and other people's questions and the responses. So call now and get it out of the way. Become one of our contributors at 217-244-9455.
Yeah. Well, we just want to encourage people to think about the role that WYLL plays in your life. And it's really easy to, you know, you turn on the radio, we're there. But I hope that people will understand that we are here really because of folks like you. Yes, in the past we have gotten some support from the government, but you know that the state of Illinois has some serious financial issues. We have had significant reductions this year on our state funding, and we simply cannot rely on the government to pay the bills. And really, we would much rather that we rely on listeners and have you be the ones that we're accountable for. You be the ones that serve. I mean, we try very hard to listen to what people say about the programming and to implement suggestions if we can. This is a community institution. We're here in Urbana. We're trying really hard to be part of the community, to look at what's going on in this community, and then reflect that. This is part of a, you know, this show is a conversation. We open it up and it's live and people can call in and, you know, we don't know what they're going to say, but they call in.
And it's civil. There's something to say about that, isn't there?
That's what we're going for, at least.
It's civil, it's informative, it's interactive. You can name lots of reasons why you listen, and we're glad that you've been sharing those with us. As you call in with your pledge, we'll take your comments any time of the year. It's only a few times a year we ask you to call in during the program and make a pledge, and that time is now. And that number is 217-244-9455 or online at willpledge.org, and we thank you so much.
All right, yeah. And if you'd like to call in with a question for Dr. Jeff Swearingen, he is our guest this morning. He is a family medicine doctor at Carl in Urbana. He is here every other month to try to answer your health questions. You can call us, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And we do also have the email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Something else I came across and was looking for things that we might talk about, it apparently is the case that more people are ending up in the hospital because of poisoning from prescription tranquilizers, sedatives, and opioids. Hospitalizations for these things have increased 65% between 1999 and 2006. I think one of the things that we know is that there are people who are using prescription medicines in a recreational way, but I think we also know that there are people who are getting into problems because they're taking a number of different things, which they may in fact gotten from doctors or maybe gotten from somebody that they know. And I think that one of the important points to make is that maybe people think, well, prescription medicines are safe. You know, that's not like an illegal drug. Doctors give them out. So they should be, you know, they're safe. But
we consider water to be safe, and yet we can drown in it. So anything with a use can be misused, just like medications with effects have potential side effects. And you're correct. Some of this is deliberate abuse of prescription medications because they can be abused. And some of it is just lack of education on patients who are then mixing a medication perhaps they got one place with a medication they got someplace else with things that are available over the counter or things that they don't consider to be drugs like alcohol. And that can be a pretty toxic combination depending on what it is that you've taken. So for physicians, there's always a concern that when controlled substances are being prescribed, they need to be prescribed for a very well-defined diagnosis and used in a very careful manner. And ideally, there should be a physician who is aware of all of the medications that a patient is taking. This is actually one of the advantages of systems where if everybody's in the system and you're using, say, an electronic medical record, as each physician adds a medication, it shows up on the list so that the next time you can see all of the medications that have been prescribed for this particular person. Now, people who abuse drugs deliberately go different places inside different systems and try to not create that kind of record. So they'll actually go to, you know, Carl one time, Christy the next. They'll go out of town another time. Yeah. The state of Illinois has tried to help this particular situation. There's actually a website that physicians can go to. And if you punch in the patient's name and birth date, all of the controlled prescriptions that have been prescribed in the state of Illinois show up. So it becomes really interesting to see who's picked up what from whom and how often. And then you can go back into that person and say, you know, this is like the 12th prescription for this particular substance you picked up from, you know, 8 different physicians. I think we have a problem here.
Okay.
And that's fortunately a very, very small minority of the patients who, you know, misuse medications. I think the majority of patients who are misusing medications do it out of lack of knowledge about what the potential complications might be if they either take too much or if they mix it with other medications.
Yeah. So at the very least, for people who are conscious of this, if they don't want to be completely honest with their doctor, and then they could bring themselves to do it, then, you know, talk with a pharmacist. If you have any kind of concerns about potential interaction, tell them, I'm taking these things. Do you see any problem with that? And they also would be in a position to say, either I think that's okay, or no, I don't think that's okay. Talk to your doctor about this before you do whatever it is you're thinking about doing.
Right.
Yeah. Is it difficult to get patients to take prescription medication as directed?
That's actually been studied many, many times. And the vast majority of people don't take medication the way it's actually prescribed, which I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but that's what we deal with. And that's what's led to medications being formulated in ways where you don't have to take them as often or the pill isn't as big. So in many instances, medications that in the past were prescribed 4 times a day have now been consolidated into, say, extended release formulations that only need to be taken once a day. Because what's basically found is the more times a day you ask somebody to take it, the less likely it is to occur.
Because they're confused, or they forget, or
they just forget. Yeah. You know, their pills are at home and they're out, so they don't have them, or they get busy and they just forget. So part of trying to help ensure compliance with medication use is to try and prescribe ways in a manner that's more likely for patients to be actually able to do it and continue with it. So there are many, many times when patients say, yeah, I'm on this particular medication, but I forget half my doses. So in essence, they're really only on half of what you think they are. And if you're adjusting medication based on, say, some laboratory result, you need to know that. Because instead of adjusting the medication, what we need to do is adjust how often they actually take it. Or find a formulation that allows them to take it fewer times a day.
Okay. Let's talk with somebody else here. We have another caller in Champaign, line number 1. Hello.
Good morning.
Hi.
I have a question. I have chronic back pain, and I'm kind of old, too, and I take an aspirin in the morning first thing, and then I also generally take 3 Advil twice a day. And you think that's doing me damage?
The major potential side effects of what are referred to as non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, this is aspirin, ibuprofen, naproxen, brand names like Motrin, Advil, Aleve, The common side effects, if you take it on an empty stomach, it can cause some fairly significant irritation. People have actually developed outright ulcers in their stomach and intestines from these types of medications. So we always caution people to be sure and take it with food to minimize any chance of stomach upset. Other side effects related to this class of medication include sodium retention. And when your body retains sodium, you tend to retain more fluid. So some people will say, you know, I get swollen when I take these, and consequently their blood pressure goes up as well. So we ask people to keep track of their blood pressure, watch for any excess swelling. People who are taking large doses for long periods of time can potentially irritate their kidneys and in some instances liver function as well. And so if you're on even over-the-counter medications in a significant dose for a significant length of time, periodically monitoring laboratory work for kidney and liver function is quite helpful.
Well, I'm on statin, so I get checked twice a year for those functions anyway, and so far so good. I was just wondering if taking 200 milligram Advil a day is way yonder too much. Of course, I'm over 200 pounds, so I don't...
In actuality, if you take ibuprofen, the standard full-strength dose is 2,400 milligrams per day.
Oh, okay.
So that would be the equivalent of 12 Advil tablets per day.
So I'm only half of that.
Exactly. So you are in no way taking an excessive dose, and if you're taking it with food and your stomach isn't bothering you, your blood pressure is okay, and you periodically get your liver and kidney functions checked, and they're fine, then I'd say you're doing well.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Okay. And I'm sure also you would want to say to people if they feel like they need to be taking 12 Advil a day, they should be talking to their doctor before they do that.
Well, it's an indicator that there's a problem of some sort, and if that particular problem hasn't been addressed in terms of figuring out what it is and talking about what other potential treatments there might be for it, it certainly would be a reasonable thing to check out before taking large quantities, at least for an extended period of time.
And this is what you would call the therapeutic dose?
Yes.
All right. Which is it's different from if you just have a headache, you take two. That's
right.
One thing. But this is if you want to get the maximum anti-inflammatory effect, but you got to take that much.
With medications like this, you're talking about either the analgesic effect. I want a pain reliever, okay, and a couple of Advil for my headache is probably all I need, versus its anti-inflammatory effect. And there you're going to need a bigger dose for a longer period of time to get that effect. Now, the major difference between the anti-inflammatory agents and acetaminophen, which is Tylenol, is that Tylenol is a pain reliever. It has analgesic benefits. It's also an antipyretic. It'll lower your temperature, okay? Mm-hmm. But it has no anti-inflammatory effect, okay? So if somebody says, you know, I have tendonitis and I want to reduce the inflammation in my tendons, Tylenol long-term probably isn't going to do you much good, but ibuprofen or one of those other medications for a few weeks may, in fact, be quite helpful.
Yeah, but then you get that problem that, unfortunately, it has for that, or maybe you have joint pain, you got arthritis or, you know, whatever. So the anti-inflammatory, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories can really help with that, but then you got this downside that for some people, they just can't tolerate that because it gives them a lot of gastric problems.
Correct. And this brings us sort of full circle back to our original caller, which is there are medications you can prescribe to block the gastric irritation caused by non-steroidal medications. But now you're adding a medication to block the side effect of the original medication that you're taking. And there are times when that's a reasonable thing to do, but there are other times where if you could say, gee, can you get by with Tylenol? And if they say, yeah, I guess, then you say, fine. You know, if that'll keep you comfortable enough, we'll stop irritating your stomach by getting you off the non-steroidal medication.
Yeah. So what is it that the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs do that causes it to produce that effect? Do they pump up the production of stomach acid?
and block some of the protective mechanisms that are normally present in the stomach.
Yeah. Okay. And are there any formulations of those things that you can buy over the counter that can help, or does that really not help?
You basically will see, say, in the pharmacy, you can buy plain aspirin, and you can buy what's called enteric-coated aspirin. And the theory here is that if I can get the aspirin through the stomach and not have it dissolve there, I'll be less likely to irritate it. So the enteric coatings on some of the over-the-counter medications are designed to allow the tablet to get into the small intestine before they dissolve, where they may be less irritating. Yeah.
And does that actually
help? For some people, it does help.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Our guest in this hour of Focus is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He is a family medicine physician at Carl in Urbana. Every other month on a Monday, he's here and we do the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. The idea is that if you have a healthcare question, you can call us and he will do his best to help you out, maybe add a little bit to your basic information. Then you may want to go and, of course, see your own doctor. But this is a place that you can start to ask questions. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And we do, again, have that email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Something else I thought I'd ask you about, and certainly I guess we've talked about this, and in fact, just an earlier caller talked about the fact that he was on statins. There, I think, within the medical community, among cardiologists and others, there's a lot of conversation going on now about who should be taking these medicines. And are there people who would benefit from taking them that aren't taking them now? And then maybe the big leap is, well, if we think it'd be good for people's cholesterol to be lower, maybe everybody should be taking them, even if right now their cholesterol seems to be, pretty much okay. Nothing that would cause you as a doctor to say, oh, we got a problem here.
A very controversial area.
Yes.
But one that can probably at least be discussed briefly in two contexts. The original studies with statin medication showed a lowering of cardiovascular mortality, all of which was attributed to the cholesterol-lowering effect of the medication. Subsequent study done with people who didn't have a lot of cardiovascular risk, and in fact their cholesterol wasn't all that high, but they were put on statins, and after a couple of years they found out, gee, they had a lower death rate from cardiovascular disease. And so they went back and they looked and they found that some of the effect that was beneficial from statins came from lowering cholesterol, but some of it came from lowering inflammation in blood vessel walls, something that they hadn't previously studied. And so they didn't attribute the statin to that effect until later. So basically, if you take folks who don't have really terrible cholesterols, but you put them on cholesterol-lowering medications like statins, if those individuals have elevated levels of inflammation in their blood vessels, they actually benefit from having those levels reduced separate from what happens to their cholesterol.
Hmm.
So there are, in fact, a subset of people who will benefit from statin medications even if their cholesterol is not that bad. So this has led to some recommendations for screening individuals with blood tests done to check for inflammation in the blood vessel walls. Now, you have to exclude inflammatory changes from anywhere else in the body because the blood test doesn't tell you where the inflammation is coming from. So there are a couple things that have to be sorted through there. But if you have an individual who says, I want to lower my cardiovascular risk, my cholesterol is not that bad, but my inflammatory markers are up, then a statin may in fact be a reasonable thing to do there. Are we at the point where we're going to dump it into the water supply? I don't think so. I don't think we'll get to that point yet, because there are still too many unanswered questions. I think one of the big questions is at what point do you start people on medication? Because there isn't any good data yet that says, gee, if I take this otherwise healthy 25-year-old woman whose cholesterol's elevated a little bit and put her on medication, there isn't any data out there that says she's going to have a lower risk of cardiovascular disease 20, 30, 40 years from now. Now, I think that's a really interesting question to ask, but the data isn't there yet. Mm-hmm. So in populations where there's defined cardiovascular risk, and this is typically your male over 40 who may have high blood pressure or diabetes or cholesterol-related problems or a family history of heart disease, those studies have been done, and there is benefit to medication. But whether it's going to go sort of public to everybody yet, don't know yet.
All right. We have a couple of callers here. We'll try to get them both. Charleston is next, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've been on Metoprol. That's Metoprol. And I'm not responding to it. And the doctor wanted to switch me to Labetaol.
Mm-hmm.
And the original prescription said that you shouldn't quit taking that beta blocker. You shouldn't quit cold turkey. You should ease off or do something with it. And the other one's also a beta blocker. Do I just stop the original one?
Because you're going from one beta blocker to another beta blocker, yes, you can just stop the one and start the other. They have slightly different chemical effects internally.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite reasonable that if you need a beta blocker for whatever conditions being treated and you're not responding to the initial one, finding something in the same general chemical class
mm-hmm.
is a very reasonable thing to do. The kind of analogy that I use sometimes with patients is that, you know, you need a pickup truck. You don't like the Dodge, so we're going to get you a Ford, okay? So you're in the same general class, but there's going to be a little difference between them, and you may respond better to one than the other.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And to Urbana for another caller, line two. Hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
I tuned in late. I don't know if this was covered or not, but my question is basically a skin infection and if there's such a thing as a routine skin infection that you treat at home, and if so, how, or does everything need to be seen? I have a rash that basically looks like acne bumps, but it's on my leg. And I'm just kind of curious because you read stuff in the news now about MRSA and this and that.
Right. And
I know. How do you take care of that, and what are the signs?
On clinical grounds, there isn't any way to identify a skin infection as being methicillin-resistant staph aureus, which is the acronym for MRSA. The only way to do that is by actually culturing the wound and sending it off to the lab. They'll first identify what bacteria it is, and then they'll identify which antibiotics it's sensitive to. But do you need to do that for every skin-related condition? No, probably not. An antibacterial soap and a little antibiotic ointment takes care of it, then that's probably fine to do at home. On the other hand, if something is progressive, it's, you know, it's getting bigger instead of smaller, or it's simply persistent and not improving with local care at home, then getting an opinion by having somebody take a look at it and either recognizing it as some other dermatologic condition or culturing it. And then treating it appropriately is certainly reasonable.
Okay, and I apologize. This is, but you know, you don't do anything to it except wash it, keep it clean, maybe some antibiotic ointment.
Correct.
But no other interventions.
No.
Okay. Thanks.
All right.
All right. Thank you. You know, now there are there's lots and lots of health information available on the web. So if you have internet access, if you want to research a particular topic, it's there, and I think now it makes it more and more possible for people to do self-diagnosis, which may be okay. I guess maybe the bottom line question, maybe it always has been, well, when do you see the doctor? When do you think I got something going here that's serious, and I don't know what it is, and I don't know what to do about it, and I'd better go and see somebody and not just think it's probably going to go away.
If you self-diagnose and the diagnosis is something that is either minor and or self-limiting, and you want to either treat it yourself or observe it for a short period of time, I don't have any problem with that. The vast majority of little ailments that befall us, fortunately, are usually benign and self-limited. If something is severe, persistent, worsening, then it's probably time to get a second opinion.
Uh-huh. Any particular symptom that really concerns you and say, look, if this is going on, don't mess around and see somebody?
So much of that is dependent on the specific characteristics of the person having the symptom. If you tell me a otherwise healthy 15-year-old girl says, gee, I'm having a little chest pain, I think of a particular set of things, most of which aren't fatal. If you tell me a 65-year-old smoker with high blood pressure is having a little chest pain, there's a whole different scenario going on in my head. So yeah. There's no one symptom that I can tell you that people should always be concerned about, because it's really going to depend on the clinical situation in which it's occurring.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to finish up because we're here at the end of our time for this time round. But I also wanted to mention that our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen, he's family medicine doctor, Ed Carl, in Urbana, is here every other month on a Monday. We call the show Talk to the Family Doctor and try to have it here as a resource that people can use it and call in and ask questions, and we hope it's helpful. And as I always say at the beginning of the program, if you're really concerned about what's going on with you, you better find somebody who can see you. Thanks very much.
My pleasure, David.
We have a couple minutes here before we hand things off to Celeste Quinn for the noon hour of news that's coming up here. So it's another opportunity for us to remind people who are listening just how important listener support is for the station. It's our spring fundraising time, and we're asking people to call or go online and make a financial contribution to the station, which means give us some money that we will use to produce programs for you for the whole rest of the year. Kim Cronick is here in studio with
yes.
me, too.
And, David, I want to remind our listeners that, yes, we are trying to have 1,000 pledges during the spring drive, which ends on Saturday. Today is our first day during the week asking for you to contribute. The number to call is 217-244-9455. We did receive a great pledge earlier in the program. We thank you very much for that pledge. If you have been listening and haven't yet called in, now's the time, 217-244-9455. In the second half of the program, we learned about statins, prescription drugs, skin rashes. I learned a whole lot myself. It's probably one of the reasons why you tune in, to get your questions answered and to hear other people's answers that probably relate to yourself. We think that's information and programming we're supporting. 40% of our contributions come from you, the listener. Now's the time to call. 217-244-9455.
Yeah, we back in July, we sat down and tried to figure out how much money we would need for the coming year to support the programs that people value. Unfortunately, we did not know that there would be additional state budget cuts that affects us directly, that affects the university, which affects us. Very uncertain, and we are about halfway to the fundraising goal that we have set, and the end of the fiscal year is at the end of June. So we're kind of coming down to the wire here. So that's really why it's so important that we hear from as many people as we possibly can. It really does. Everybody and every person's contribution makes a real big difference.
And we're looking at about 100 pledges a day, a little more than that, 125 to make our goal. We are at over 50 for the day, which is good. So we need to double that and then some. And I know we can do it with your call at 217-244-9455.